Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Seeking Sustainability. It has been a very, very long time since I posted an episode. I felt a little guilty. This episode that you're about to listen to, I actually recorded back in March, and I have a whole lineup of episodes I've recorded over the last couple months that I just haven't posted yet. But yeah, since this is like a fun side project kind of thing for me, I didn't want to burn myself out. So I just decided to take a break from it and step away for, I don't know, kind of however long I felt like stepping away from it for. And, you know, we talk about sustainability. The whole point of this podcast is sustainability. And that typically is referring, obviously, to like sustaining and regenerating the state of the environment, which we'll talk about in this episode with regenerative agriculture. But when we talk about doing all of these things, we also have to sustain ourselves. I'm in a place of trying to figure out how the heck to do that. I don't know. There's no right answer, I don't think. But, you know, sustaining our energy and sustaining ourselves and our own creativity in order to continue to sustain our activism and sustain the projects that we work on. So those things directly relate to one another. And, you know, I think in order to continue doing this project and doing this podcast for fun, I figured it would just be okay to step away for a little bit and take a break. So that way I don't resent, you know, doing these episodes or do it just for the sake of churning out content, because that's not at all what it's about. So with that said, so this episode, like I said, was recorded back in March, and I conversed with Jesse Smith, who is the Director of Land Stewardship for White Buffalo Land Trust. And they are a really awesome organization based out in California that practices, promotes, and develops systems of regenerative agriculture for local, regional, and global impact. They also just launched this project that they've been working on called Halama Canyon Ranch. So fascinating, this huge project. That's so cool. And Jesse talks more about it in the episode. Also, as always, all of the links and references mentioned in the episode will be linked in the description box below. But Jesse was really interesting also because his background is actually in graphic design. Like, that's what he studied in college. But then he ended up in the world of land stewardship and regenerative agriculture, which I thought was really cool. And I kind of related to that, and that resonated with me personally. So he talks a little bit about that. And you can donate to White Buffalo Land Trust. I'll link that in the description box below. And also, my friend Hazel, who was in our last episode, reached out to me, and she mentioned that she's partnering with this awesome organization in Uganda, which is where Hazel's from, that is having a virtual fundraiser concert called Loud Activates, where the proceeds of the event will go towards educating kids that have been out of school for over a year due to COVID-19. It's a $10 donation, and you can also give any other amount. So I'll be donating, and I hope you guys do too. And if not, just at least check it out. It seems like a really, really cool organization and project. So yeah, so that is my little spiel for today. And of course, without any further ado, let's welcome Jesse Smith of White Buffalo Land Trust to the Seeking Sustainability podcast. So typically when my first question is always like, what does it mean to be an environmentalist to you? But since I saw that you were the director of land stewardship, I thought I would reframe the question a little bit and ask, in your opinion or from your perspective, what does it mean to be a steward of the land, and why is that important?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. And I love the nuancing of your line of questioning, depending on the context of your conversation. You know, being able to adjust on the fly as to who you're talking to, the time in which you're talking, and ultimately the way that you're feeling today is an important skill set to be able to cultivate, instead of kind of just falling into the automation of, well, here's my list of questions, this is how I always ask them, and you're going to fit into my rubric whether you like it or not. So I appreciate that first and foremost.
Thank you.
And I think that is ultimately, you know, my perspective on land stewardship is that reciprocity that we find ourselves within once we start to recognize our connection to kind of greater and lesser wholes. You know, that kind of spectrum of, you know, we are an entity that is nested within larger entities. So I'm an individual that works for an organization that works within an industry that is trying to change a system. But even, you know, within me, I have systems that I, you know, both mental systems as well as physical systems that are nested amongst me that make me up. I've got my digestive system, I've got my nervous system. So just recognizing, I've got my, you know, gut biome system, like all those kind of things, recognizing the interconnectedness of all that is part of the journey to realizing that everything that I do and everything that I think and the way that I think has real ramifications onto the landscapes in which I interact. And so taking responsibility over that, which is essentially taking stewardship over the way that you show up, the being that you bring to the world, as well as the functional activities, like the things that I do, is part of how I intend to steward the living systems around me. And so just being conscious of what we eat, what we wear, kind of what we support, the language we use, and the way that we engage with people is part of kind of being a land steward in the highest potential of the term.
I love that. Yeah, reciprocity. I talk about that all the time. I feel like it's one of the best words to like describe these kind of conversations or these kinds of relationships. Yeah, and I would love to hear, well, of course, I'm going to ask for you to talk about White Buffalo Land Trust and all of your guys' work and projects, but I since you said you were a designer and now you're the director of land stewardship, I would love to hear about how you fell into the job that you're currently in and what brought you to where you are now.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, so many people land in a job by way of opportunity. And I would say that, you know, I could look at it from that perspective, but as a designer in that design process, I also have to respect the way that I've gone about both my kind of upbringing and the way that my parents have designed that to my education and the way I kind of designed my way through school. And then ultimately as a young professional, kind of how I envisioned my role within the work that I've done. And so I've always wanted to work from a place of collaboration, but also with like self-driven motivation. Like I don't want to be isolated, but I also don't want to be kind of a piece of a puzzle and a cog in the wheel, you know, another brick in the wall, whatever you want to say. You know, I think that you know, to kind of express the nuances of who I may be, I remember sitting in a freshman course and, you know, a professor, you know, a room of 200, 300 kids asking who here wants to graduate and get a job, and the entire stadium, you know, raised their hand, and I looked around and I was like, you all want jobs? like I want to work. I want to work every day. I want to love what I do, but I don't want a job, you know? And I think that was just like my projection of what a job meant and what like deep meaningful work meant. And so when I was kind of a junior designer, freelance consultant, branding, you know, that kind of stuff, I quickly realized that a lot of my design work was being utilized for a very kind of like functional assets, business cards, websites, flyers that ultimately were part of the kind of paradigm of planned obsolescence. You know, we just make it in order to throw it away. You know, we just, you know, we know that it's like print a bunch of units. And that was how we were quantifying our success, was how many of what we designed were made. Whereas I was exposed to kind of a living system design framework through permaculture that looked at kind of human-centric design processes that used that design process to impact communities and processes and systems that evolved and got better with time, that didn't degrade, hopefully if you're a good designer, didn't degrade, but actually evolved. Yeah. and continued to develop. And so that was like a big paradigm shift for me. It was like, oh wow, I can use these design skill sets of just my pattern recognition of form and line and color and, you know, class, and just how we looked at all the different assets and compiled them and engaged with them and phased them over time and all those kind of things, not only with pixels and ink and paper, but with plants and animals and equipment and humans. And that just kind of was a quick slippery slope where I found this meshing of my very, very functional design acumen, where, you know, farmers need business cards and websites and, you know, packages for products and all that kind of stuff, where landscapes also need that same kind of design thinking. And so, started working in consultation and agricultural system design with colleagues and exploring the world, you know, working in throughout Africa and Europe and here in the Southwest United States, and just was exposed to the more global principles that were applicable across landscapes and cultures. And then obviously the nuanced kind of context-driven design that really defined the practices and the techniques that are not exportable. You can't just say, well, you want to meet the same outcome and here's the principle. You apply the same practice over and over again, because it's going to be different from, you know, farm to farm, neighbor to neighbor, person to person, day to day. And so that's kind of been the driving factor or driving force that's defined my will to continue to work in this world.
Wow. That was like so interesting for me. That's like, cause I mean, I'm just starting my kind of career journey, but it's a little bit similar in some sense. And that's just so cool how you transitioned from design to a landscape. Wow. That's so interesting. That was like a really cool thing for me to listen to. So if you could talk about White Buffalo Land Trust, so who you all are, what is the work that you do? Kind of broad question, yeah. But just overview.
How long do we have? Like, you have the elevator pitch here, or
whatever you feel called to.
Fair enough. Well, I'll do my best to express it in the context of this conversation and not regurgitate some pre-prepared answer, because, you know, obviously there's the repetition sometimes can breed an automatic response, but you know, ultimately we're seeking to achieve a systemic paradigm shift in the way that humans interact with agricultural systems. And to say that in layman's terms, we're trying to reconnect humans to ecological function, the way that our soil health works, the way our water systems work, the way our nutrients are cycled, and the way that humans, farmers, ranchers, communities are being held in the context of how we grow food, fiber, medicine, fuel, all of those things. So this is different from that of conservation. It's different from that of restoration. It's a difference of that of kind of ornamental landscape design. Mm. We have a functional component of growing food, fiber, medicine, and fuel, with the outcomes of that process being a healthier, more vibrant, more resilient ecosystem. And we consider humans as part of that ecosystem. Now, part of the way that we show up to do that work is through different fields of focus, and that's differentiated through our on-the-ground land stewardship, you know, hands in the soil, you know, roots in the ground, you know, doing the work that ultimately is the outcome of a lot of the kind of philosophical thinking of what this paradigm shift should look like. And we're putting it into practice, the perennialization of our agriculture, the management of our landscapes for water cycling, water reticulation, and increase in biodiversity through native plant plantings, diverse agricultural system plantings and plantings, all that kind of stuff. So direct land stewardship is one component. We also see the need for a kind of reimagining of how we educate and communicate these findings. So we have an education and training program. The training is focused on land stewards who are looking for kind of a deeper understanding of the ecological principles that then can be transferable into the practices and techniques that are context specific to them. So training the next generation of land stewards, while also providing the educational experiences for the broader public, our food system providers, our policy advisors, our educators and teachers and students and, artists, you know, just changing the way that people understand how the world functions, ecological systems function. we also believe that having our fingers on the ground allows us an opportunity to engage with the research and monitoring and scientific process to be able to express the dynamic, complex living systems that are our agricultural landscapes in a manner where you can kind of delve in deeper and derive deeper insights into the connection between practices and outcomes, even if those aren't direct. You know, it's not that I did this thing and this thing happened. It's that I did this suite of things and then this diverse expression can be monitored. And so sometimes that's difficult within the kind of confines of a very regimented scientific process. But that's the intent of our work is to express that complexity through science and research. And so those are kind of the three components. Everything is in service of our land stewardship, but we have education and training and scientific research and monitoring. And then the fourth field of focus, which is kind of the combination of all three of those, is product development. Ultimately taking, you know, what we do, kind of what we learn and how we express and communicate and share that and bundling that all together into kind of essentially like a totem, a talisman of all of that work, you know, that is a bite of food, you know, a fantastic morsel for us to either nourish our bodies with, whether it be, you know, for food or for medicine, and creating things in the marketplace so people can vote with their dollar, that they can express their values in the marketplace, that in that moment of midweek rush and trying to feed the family, you can, you know, buy this over that and at least feel somewhat connected to what your principles align with. And so bringing things forward into the marketplace is the other main field of focus.
Regenerative agriculture. Can you explain for those who haven't heard of it or aren't super familiar with it, what regenerative agriculture is and why it's different than conventional agriculture? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that regenerative agriculture and the way we hold it is one of diverse perspectives. You know, it is not the same for every community. For those who enter the conversation from one of kind of agriculture and soil and ecology, it a lot of times will revolve around the kind of principles of ecosystem function, which is, you know, this soil health and the water resources and the biodiversity and the farmer and rancher livelihoods, you know, making sure that they're, you know, profitable and well taken care of and healthy. For others who are entering the conversation from one of historically being either disenfranchised or extracted from, it's one of equity and inclusion and respect. That is a hallmark of it being regenerative at its core. You know, for others who are really addressing the global imperative of climate change and the impacts of that on all the different systems, then a lot of times it really has a distinct focus on carbon and or greenhouse gas sequestration or avoidance. Yes to all of those. That is the diversity of regenerative agriculture. But when it's expressed outwardly or attempt, there's an attempt to define it. Sometimes there are key components that are missed and or lost in the discussion that can create a contentious nature around, well, you're not holding it the way that I'm holding it, and thus your regenerative agriculture is not as good as my regenerative agriculture. And I think that it's important for us to, when engaging with individuals, whether it be an individual person or an individual entity and organization, to ask the question of what has brought them to the point to consider themselves engaging in the conversation of regenerative agriculture. So self-defined, affiliated with, like, I am a regenerative agriculturalist, or I am a individual that's trying to regenerate agriculture. or I am contributing to a movement of regenerative agriculture, when you say that or when you align with that, then it's important for either you to express or for people to kind of do some digging and some sleuthing, or just see behind, okay, well, what's brought you to the table, to understand what that perspective might be. You know, for us, for me and for what this organization stands for, it's really focused on the kind of nodal network of individuals and organizations who are working within that space, and the expression of our node, which is place-driven. You know, we are land-based and we are place-based. So our work is defined within a community, and that hard boundary is not hard at all. I mean, there's a fuzziness, there's a grayness to, you know, is it the county borders? Is it the climactic boundaries? Is it, you know, and so we're still feeling that out, but we definitely know where we work. And we know what our community is asking for, and our community, which we consider ourselves a part of, is asking for agriculture to take a deep look at the impacts and both the positive and the negative impacts of how we provide food and fiber and medicine, both for within our community and, you know, as exports, because we have a big export market here in Santa Barbara County.
Yeah.
And how we then care for our soil health, our water resources, and our biodiversity, and our farmer and rancher communities. And I think that you know, that is going to be, you know, the piece that kind of carries through.
Yeah, in the Halama Canyon Ranch campaign, I think you said something, it was like halfway through the video, and it was, you said something like land management or something of the nature needs to be done in like a place-based contextual way.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely didn't quote you perfectly on that one.
You got it close.
Yeah, you said it way more eloquently. But by that, do you mean like creating more regionalized systems?
So that's, I mean, yes. I mean, that's essentially the core of that is to look back into the history of how a region, a culture came to be within a region. Yeah. You know, so what do we do? What values do we hold? You know, what are the spoken or unspoken agreements? And thus asking the question of where we come from, where are we now, and where is our next best step, can only be defined in the context of place. You can't be this model of exported, you know, behavior where this just works everywhere, or for everyone. And so that's the root of what I was speaking to, is that what we do is going to be defined by where we are and who we are.
Yeah, that's like in the regenerative agriculture course that I'm in through Soil Health Academy. I think it was Gabe Brown who was saying something about taking in, looking into like, or doing things in the right, in the context of your land, like what makes sense for your area. I did not word that well.
No, you, but, I mean, you worded it perfect. I mean, I could try to grow, you know, some crazy crops out here just because I could, but I would be subsidizing those by major inputs of either labor or water or nutrients, and maybe I could, you know, crunch the numbers and get that to work out to be profitable, but not paying attention to what the long term ramifications are of that, or the impact on either the labor that's being extracted in order to push the prices down, or the watershed that's being extracted from in order to subsidize the irrigation needs, or the, you know, I mean, in context of, you know, some of the animal systems, the other landscapes that are being extracted from in order to subsidize their feed needs in the non-growing seasons. So all of those things, you know, can be done. And just recognizing, you know, either the inefficiencies or the inequalities in all of that, and deciding as a community or as individuals, like, this is what I'm going to do, but even, you know, better is as a community, this is what we value as the next best step. And this is how we're going to support it. We're going to source from those producers that are doing this way, or we are going to subsidize, you know, these activities because they align with outcomes that we seek to achieve, or you know, we're going to highlight these programs because they are the ones that support the needs of those that are sometimes falling through the cracks or being marginalized or unsupported. And so that's community-led activism at its best. When we can have a shared purpose, what are we trying to achieve here? And ultimately, we want an agricultural system that carries forth into the future with a unique expression of place and culture.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Literally in the course, I'm pretty sure he said, like, take into context what role your land plays in the community. And also too, like, doing things in a not very contextualized or conscious way, I feel like is the result of seeing things only through this like industrialized light, when you're not respecting nature's natural rhythms and like what makes sense for that region and for that land in that area, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, it's just funny because, you know, you use what makes sets regenerative agriculture apart from, you know, conventional agriculture and the conventions of anything, you know, but in this context, the conventions of agriculture, they shift from generation to generation. So what we talk about as far as the conventional agriculture is that of the agriculture that, you know, has been practiced in living memory. And by that, I mean, those that are, you know, the 60 to 80 who are now the matriarchs and patriarchs of, you know, family farms across the country, you know, they grew up post-World War II in the industrial kind of boom of agriculture, where the application or the reappropriation of these assets of machinery and tanks and chemicals were then applied to agriculture, which ultimately, you know, to the detriment of our diversity and our soil health and our resilience. And that's being realized now, but we're talking about the conventions in the context of that period. Whereas if you went one generation before, their conventional agriculture looked a lot different.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, we have to be conscious of the fact that this is not a static conversation. We're constantly evolving, and there's more. I mean, you know, I'm a young professional. I see that, but I'm also now, you know, in a position where there are new minds coming to the table that were, you know, born, you know, after the year 2000, that have a different perspective on a lot of things when it comes to the role of technology and social media and virtual reality and games, and like, where I'm just like, whoa, like that's a different world. But other people just like, they didn't grow up, you know, without internet or without smartphones. And so it's just a different kind of personality. And so, you know, I'm quickly going to become the conventional part of that, that conversation in the next 20 years. And that's okay. Cause that's what, but I want other people to build upon what we do, as long as it's going in the right direction. So the invitation to be part of the regenerative ag movement is an open invitation for anyone who wants to take their next best step. But you just can't you can't stay static, and you can't go backwards. You know, you have to understand that, you know, these living systems, these biological systems, these human systems, you know, have to be supported and evolved and developed and engaged with to their betterment. And if you're saying, well, I made it, I got there, I did that, I'm here, then you're falling behind the eight ball. And if you're actively trying to diminish or deplete or extract from them, then you're definitely missing the ball.
Oh, I have to ask again, this is kind of a personal question, but to go from a design background to working in the position that you're in, did you ever feel like imposter syndrome? Like, I don't have a degree in this, or I don't, like, you know, that's something I'm going through.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. And I think that there can be shades of it that are like fleeting, because I think that I had a unique perspective on education in the first place, where I love to learn and I love school, but the kind of external justification of my own worth was never an issue for me. Like, it wasn't like a teacher gives you a good grade and that means you're a good person,
yeah,
or like a smart person. And so I always had this weird impasse with my teachers who were like, wow, you're just such a, you're such an intelligent student. You're so good. But like, you like, you sometimes you're, you miss assignments or something. I was like, I know. I mean, but I learned so much in your school. And then I like went out and started my own business and I'm doing it. Like, I just, I love what I'm learning and I'm doing it. But like, sometimes doing it in the world was more important to me than like writing the report or something like that. And I get that, yeah, that just didn't, like, it didn't fit into that model of education. And so they, you know, it's hard for them to manage me sometimes, but I just never, you know, I just never really had, I mean, I'll never forget, you know, my final capstone class. I essentially, you know, finished everything early. I mean, I've had multiple times I've had to write these big, you know, essays to justify me finishing a course early so I can go and do something else, which was either take another course or start a company. And my teacher was just like, you got to be there for your final presentation in person. I was like, I'm sorry. Like, we're starting an artisan creamery and we have like 600 gallons of organic milk that's delivered to our creamery on that day. Like, I can't reschedule that. Like, that we started a business, yeah, based off of what I had learned, and like, I'll do it early, I'll do it digitally, like, I'll do whatever you need. And ultimately she's like, I don't know what to do with you. Like that's the rubric. Every other student has to abide by that. Like, how am I? I was like, no, but you understand, like, I don't care if you don't, like, if you, I learned what I came here to learn. You got to give me a bad grade. That's fine. Like, if you feel that you got to do that, like, that's not, no skin off my back. She's like, but you won't have the GPA. I was like, I've never been defined by the worth of my GPA. Like, I just, it's never been a part of who I identified with.
Yeah.
And so I know what I know, and I understand who I am, and I'm confident in how I show up and engage with people in the work that I do. And I think that sometimes I fall into like that defensive mode when there's individuals who have the credentials or the respect or something like that, and you're making a pitch or a conversation and they're like, they start grilling. You're like, oh, so where did you go to school? Or like, what course? And you're just, and like, you're like, oh, and you start to like say, like justify who you are by where you went to school.
Right.
And without like wanting to take the kind of slightly confrontational approach, we're like, well, why do you want to know? Like, what value does that offer you? Like, you know, and so sometimes that's the kind of the conflict or the fleeting conflict of like, oh, like, do I need to engage on this level right now? Or do I like take the time to upgrade the conversation? And so, yeah, that's my take on it.
I wanted to ask if you could talk about Halama Canyon Ranch, because that's really cool. And I was going through your guys' website and was just totally, oh my gosh, blown away by the magnitude of that project. So if you could just talk about what that is and why it's so important.
Well, it is the magnitude is significant for us, and we feel for the community. So I would kind of throw it back on you, is what was it that spoke to you? What was it that piqued your interest? What was the thing that most interested you? And maybe we'll use that as a starting point.
I guess when I was looking through, it was like the link that was like the campaign for Halama Canyon Ranch. And when you scrolled, it showed all of these different components of the project. And I guess what I liked about it is, I don't know if I'm going to explain this well. I feel like in these conversations, even with like the term regenerative agriculture, people tend to like things, but here is this like project that is this all-encompassing, dynamic, multifaceted embodiment of all of these different conversations and ideas. And that's like kind of what piqued my interest.
Cool. Yeah.
And it seemed ambitious too for any organization to take
on.
Yeah,
100%. I mean, that's, we operate on that, in that liminal space between kind of reality and potential. Like, you know, what's the point of trying to replicate something that someone else has done? We're trying to push the envelope into a space of what others haven't been able to do, or haven't figured out how to do. And yet we see the kind of process in order to accomplish our goals. And so bringing those different elements to the table and kind of constellating them in a way where they start to interact with each other, you know, depending on who we're engaging with, sometimes at the intersection of agriculture, conservation, and research, Other times it's in the intersection of, you know, agriculture, education, and kind of equity, inclusion, and diversity. You know, other times it's at the intersection of agriculture, market development, and kind of technology. You know, so we're seeing all these different kind of spheres of influence and creating in different Venn diagrams and finding ourselves at the nexus to be able to achieve change. So, you know, one of the things that I'm really excited about this project is the opportunity to blend kind of an enterprise focused agricultural model with kind of like an education, research, and training component, while also bringing in the kind of creative, artistic, human development, like really developing our capacity to envision a different form of agriculture through the experiential understanding of how it works. So standing in an intact ecosystem, a functioning ecosystem, can be, you know, dramatically inspirational for, you know, architects and songwriters and painters and poets and chefs. And so having this place be a point of inspiration while also nested within the kind of the functional reality of running an agricultural business. And so that's really at the heart of it, as well as it's unique. It's like it's unique by not being unique. And I think that was really exciting for us, where it's like, wow, we found this little corner of the world that's like no place else. But it's like where everyone else is dealing with, like, oh, you got some grassland and rangeland environments and you're running animals. Like, we have that. We can talk about that. Like, oh, you have, you know, the back 40 has oak woodlots and savanna oak woodlands on it. We have that. Like, oh, you're trying to talk about the stream that's running through your fields. Like, oh yeah, we have those riparian corridors. Oh, you're talking about, like, you know, brush abatement and wildfire abatement and sage scrub brush and chaparral and steep slopes. Like, we have that to talk about. Like, oh, you're talking about the orchard or a vineyard operation. You're talking about the managed agroforestry. Yeah, that's what we're doing as well. And so, like, the fact that there's all these different, we call them ecotones, you know, we have this gradient of the property and the different tonalities of those different ecotypes all kind of blend together. We can discuss any of them in either kind of in isolation or as part of a larger whole and how they interact. And so it's those beautiful kind of blending of that.
So cool.
And that's what,
that's like, so it's awesome.
What's really exciting, because that's not special to our property. That's all over Santa Barbara County. That's all over California. That's all over the Mediterranean regions of the world. Those are the different ecotones that have been around for millennia. And so it allows us to work where we are with people who are having similar kind of ecological dynamics and have an impact on a global kind of population of land stewards who are dealing with similar situations. And, you know, I think that another really exciting piece for me is our team's vision around how we blend this very kind of land-based soil, water, plant, animal kind of living system engagement with the kind of digital high-tech kind of communication, the different fields that are invisible, you know, the remote sensing and monitoring of them, so that we can give access to a greater population of individuals who may not be able to, you know, come out and set foot on the property very often. And, you know, we intend to have a robust and very in-depth program related offering for people to come out and visit the property. But just the fact that it is where it is means that that's going to be confined to, you know, people either travel or there's, you know, the local people within, call it an hour and a half, 2 hour drive. And there's people all over the world, you know, that want to see these kind of projects evolve. And so by utilizing that kind of the opportunity we're in right now, where sensors and database management and kind of Internet of Things and smartphones and satellites and you know, all these things are now at a price point and accessibility point and a design point where whether I want to pick one off the shelf or customize one for our needs, there's enough people to understand how to do it. They're at a price point that it's possible. And we can actually bring that data from a kind of old world, like spreadsheet type interface to whether it's gamification and virtual reality or augmented reality to, you know, integrating with, you know, education and STEAM learning and programming or, you know, the kind of 3D model, kind of digital twin watching in real time, hydrological fluctuations of soil moisture, stream flow.
Oh, that'd be so
and
cool.
So that's essentially what we're in the process of designing right now in response to our initial kind of monitoring strategy is that kind of mesh network overlay of a digital skin on the property. And just like a human skin, you know, our epidermis being our kind of outermost, you know, organ, it's the thing that we interact with all these. I mean, it's the thing that gets the UV light rays or it gets, you know, the cell reception, you know, hits our bodies and we don't feel it, but it doesn't mean that it's not coming through that external layer. And so similarly for the property, creating that digital skin will allow us to both receive and express so much more than what we could otherwise. So that's something that's really, I think, unique to this project. And is will start to express the holism of what we're looking at, with also self-recognition of kind of technology and service of living systems is still at a very early age. And so there's no way that we can, or sometimes would even really want to capture the fullness of that living system expressions, because there's still a mystery and a spiritual nature that I think should be left out of the airwaves, if you will. So just being, you know, conscious and co-creative in how we select which data we collect and which data we communicate and how that's done, stuff like that.
Wow, that's so cool. Oh my gosh, that's wild. So in your position as director of land stewardship, what kind of responsibilities do you have in relation to this project? Like, what does your role look like for taking on something like this? Probably a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. I think that in a nutshell, you know, my responsibilities are overall kind of ranch land stewardship vision. So a lot of what we intend to do on the property, the kind of agricultural interventions, the conservation interventions and restoration programs, that really falls under my purview. You know, just managing of team members and subcontractors as they come into relationship with our organization, and that kind of developmental process so that they build their capacity to do their job well and kind of self-govern, but also making sure that it's nested within the larger whole. Is a big part of what I do. And then kind of that cross communication between kind of science research partners, as well as the kind of education and training programs and partners, to be able to kind of once again nest it within our organizational purview, land management, and so on and so forth. I've, you know, co-created each of our ag plans, our monitoring plans, our communication design plans. I mean, I was the first employee of the organization, you know, partner with our founder and president. So it's been a big part of kind of the genesis of this organization. It was just kind of bringing it forth and building the team. And I've been involved since the beginning. And then I still play a kind of designer's role as well. You know, whether it be packaging design for our food brand or communication design for our printer, web materials, and my partner Anna, she has a big role in that as well, and we work great together, both in life and in work. So it's a privilege to be able to work with my wife and family in this, and we started our relationship working together 13 years ago, and so it's just an amazing opportunity to continue it in this vein.
Oh, Anna's the one I think who emailed me back in the beginning. Oh, wow. That's so cool. Oh, that's awesome that you get to work with your partner. And That's definitely like a special kind of relationship to have. Wow, your job is so dynamic. Oh my gosh.
I'm never awesome. Bored, and you know, and no day is ever the same. I mean, that's one of the best things about the work that we're in.
That's awesome.
Is that every day is different, and I love that. You know, it's hard at times, but you don't get bored.
And is Anna the head of product development?
No, Anna's in charge of programs and engagement. So she really works on our education and training programs, as well as kind of all outward expression of the org to donors, contributors, volunteers, visitors, all of the, you know, all of our stakeholders. She really plays a forefront in that and organizing, yeah, all of our programs and stuff like that.
Cool. So do you have any advice for anyone who is kind of pursuing any sort of career that involves land stewardship, or even is just trying to cultivate like a, you know, more symbiotic or healthier relationship with the land themselves?
Yeah, I would say kind of considering yourself and what your role is in the work that you want to do. It's important to kind of start with what change you're trying to seek in the world. Like what looking outwards into whether you call it your, you know, your life cycle or, you know, the next cycle of your life, understanding, you know, what system you see your being best suited to address change within. And if you can kind of start there by saying, you know, I see there's important work to be done within the fashion industry, or there's something that I have to address within our like policy dynamics. Or for me, it was like our food system truly needs to be addressed from a local, regional, contextual basis. And by answering that question, you can then really, clarify what your role can be in that. Well, how do I need to show up in order to address that change? That then kind of leads to, okay, now who do I need to work with? You know, what company do I want to work with? What partnerships do I want to create? What collaborators? Who do I need to hire? Who do I need to work for? Whatever it may be. But I think that contextualizing it in kind of where you want to seek change, what system you want to seek change within, and what you need to bring to the table in order to seek that change, and ultimately who you need to work with, will help people who are looking for their next best step. And sometimes there's a few different steps to get to the place where you can do your best work. Sometimes it's not always finding the right job. Sometimes it's finding the right state of mind. And there's different paths to all of that. So
that's some good advice. That's really good advice. So my closing question is actually backtrack. How can people support, your guys' work?
Yeah. Depending on who you are, where you are, what you want to do. There's obviously, opportunities for education and training. So we have a great speaker series that people can engage with. So getting on our mailing list to learn more about our speaker series. If you're a land steward yourself, keeping up to date with our trainings. We have a 10-day holistic management intensive starting next Monday. We are always, you know, spreading the word about our food brand. And so figure8foods.com. Go and share the love with friends and family members and fellow foodies. We have our naturally fermented persimmon vinegar in the marketplace right now with a new SKU on its way. We have a great deal of opportunity in the next couple years to grow the team around our organization in relationship to Paloma Canyon Ranch and our flagship farm at Summerland. And so making sure if you are ever interested in the data side or the education side or the communication side or the land stewardship side, to make sure to, you know, feel free to reach out and send us a resume or a letter of interest or something like that. We take those very seriously, and we make sure to always bring those back to the team and hold them on file until opportunities or openings might be available. Especially interns, those that are in kind of higher level undergrad or graduate degrees who might have interest in projects, research projects, or special projects associated with our work, feel free to reach out. And then, you know, obviously we're a 501c3 nonprofit. So anyone who is looking to support through philanthropy or looking in the future to kind of program related investments on some of our agricultural enterprises, if they have a foundation, then that's something that we're always interested in, or other people who just might have projects that are analogous to ours. If you're in the central kind of coastal California area and see some overlap between your business and our business, you know, making sure that we know about each other so we can see if there's some threads that we can weave together. That's you know, we're in the midst of our capital campaign right now for Halama Canyon Ranch and very nearly ending the first phase, but still looking to raise funds for the acquisition price for the property, and then we're moving on to subsequent phases for infrastructural development and stuff like that. So obviously that capital campaign is still ongoing and looking for support. So yeah, any and all are available.
Awesome. And my closing question is, as an individual and a steward of the land, what gives you hope for the future? Kind of a deep question.
What gives me hope for the future is, I think that future is not guaranteed for the individual, but it's guaranteed for all. Like, the future is going to come regardless. I guess that might be a metaphysical question, you know, if you believe in kind of a linear kind of progression of time, but we're going to continue to move forward and we're going to continue to evolve, and time is going to continue to go on, which is just going to breed new opportunities for us to learn and evolve and engage. So it's, I think that sometimes the humility of humans to realize our small speck of dust within the greater cosmos and our small kind of timestamp within the greater kind of geologic time arc is just like, okay, like, are we trying to save the world? No. It's like, we're trying to preserve our like level of comfort for a little bit longer. And hopefully we can also, you know, somehow, you know, uphold some semblance of responsibility for the larger biodiversity loss crisis that we're in the midst of. But I just see so much innovation, so much human potential out there to be able to share what we learn with the younger generation, have that evolved and upgraded and reapplied. And I've got a 7-year-old daughter. I mean, what's there not to be hopeful for? She's intelligent. She's excited about life. She loves land and animals and farming. And so if we expose younger generations to being able to climb in trees and, you know, play in mud and water and count earthworms, like, you think they're going to slip into the same kind of extractive, you know, mental paradigm that, you know, some of the past generations have held up as the way of doing business? I don't think so. So it's just creating the situations and the circumstances for more people to engage with living systems, and progressive change will be inevitable. So, I don't take it as being hopeful. I just take it as a foregone conclusion that we're going to evolve somehow.
Thank you again, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of Seeking Sustainability. If you enjoyed this episode or any others that you've listened to, then make sure to follow the podcast on whatever platform you're tuning in from. Also, to stay connected, you can follow the podcast Instagram at seekingsustainability_podcast and my personal Instagram at julia.planford. As always, feel free to reach out to me regarding any questions, comments, or episode requests. And of course, share this podcast with anyone who you feel might be interested in learning a bit more about environmentalism and sustainability as well. Thanks, everyone, and I will talk to you guys soon.